This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello and welcome to Captive Audience, the show where we force feed the movies we love to the people we love. This week I'm your host, Sean Roney, and today I'm joined by my friends and colleagues, Alex Ward and Edwin James. This week we're watching the 1988 half-animated, half-live-action masterpiece, Who Framed Roger Rabbit? Captive Audience is a reaction video in podcast form, as every week we try to show a guest on our show a film they've never seen before. My good friend Alex has never seen Who Framed Roger Rabbit, and I'm so excited to make him watch it. This movie was so important to me as a kid, I must have watched it upwards of 50 times before I was even 10 years old. Although the movie is full of adult themes and jokes, all that stuff goes right over your head as a kid, and you're just left awestruck by a world where cartoons are real. It supercharged my imagination, and I think it's partly responsible for my love of cinema and ultimately my career in film production. The movie is a hard-boiled crime noir meets slap-happy Looney Tunes-style animation. Set in 1947 Hollywood, Roger, who is a cartoon rabbit, is framed for murder and must seek the help of Eddie Valiant, a bourbon-soaked human detective who just so happens to hate all tunes. Not only is the movie wildly funny and entertaining, it is a dazzling feat of technical filmmaking, combining live action and animation with a staggering amount of practical effects and extraordinary acting performances. Roger Rabbit is currently streaming on Disney Plus or available for rent on other services. So if you, like Alex, have never seen it before, don't be such a sourpuss. Go and watch it now, and then meet back up with us in Toontown.
This is the tale of an up-and-coming movie star named Roger Rabbit and a down-and-out private detective named Eddie Valiant.
Ooga booga!
Every moment they were together was a new adventure in trouble.
Hide me, Eddie! Please!
It's a motion picture about friendship.
Make it easy, booga! Please, Eddie! Don't tell me you're making a big mistake!
Love. Compassion.
All right, I'm sorry I yanked your ears.
All the time you yanked my ears?
Murder.
Marvin Acme. The rabbit cacked him last night.
Remember, you never saw me.
Sex.
I'd do anything for my husband, Mr. Valiant. Anything.
And violence.
Tunes gets him every time.
You wouldn't have any idea where the rabbit might be.
Got a thing for rabbits, huh?
The whole thing stinks like yesterday's diapers.
It's a comedy a little different from all the rest.
I'm a pig!
I'm a toon!
I'm not bad. I'm just drawn that way.
But tell me, Eddie. Is that a rabbit in your pocket, or you're just happy to see me?
Touchstone Pictures and Steven Spielberg present a Robert Zemeckis film.
We toons may act idiotic, but we're not stupid.
Who Framed Roger Rabbit?
Gentlemen, walking out of the movie theater, what'd you think? Who Framed Roger Rabbit?
What a fun ride that was. I want to get back in line and go on the ride again. Holy moly.
Speaking of, have you been on the ride?
Yeah, I was going to say, there's a Disneyland ride.
Is there really?
There's a Toontown. It's called, there's a whole Toontown.
Well, I've been to Toontown. Mm-hmm. I went to Toontown as a boy.
Yeah. You ride in the cab and you drift
Benny.
Around.
This is ringing bells. These are ringing dormant memory bells for me here. Going to Disneyland. I forget. I was not very old. This was a while ago. But Toontown must have come out right, or like early 90s, because this movie came out late 80s.
Yeah, definitely.
So I feel like I was there just after they opened Toontown.
It was probably brand new. Alex, you had never seen this movie before.
Never seen it. And I've mentioned this before on last episodes, but not only had I not seen it, my understanding of the plot of what the overall movie was absolutely zero in terms of the only thing I knew was there was a mixture of live animation or live action and animation.
Weren't aware that it was a film noir, a hard boiled.
I'll take it one step further. I wasn't even aware this was like Looney Tunes. I thought it was just a weird, like, I thought Roger Rabbit was the only animated character in this movie.
Okay.
Like, I kind of knew it was about movies, or it was about like Hollywood. And I thought Roger was the only animated character. And I don't know why I had this memory or feeling.
You must
but
have
I
been so
thinking,
excited to see everybody.
I was, but I remember thinking from the little I knew it. It was like, I think Roger Rabbit's a bad actor. He's a bad actor. He's a force of bad in the movie. None of this was true. This was just what I thought going.
But you must have known, you knew about Jessica Rabbit, though.
I knew about Jessica Rabbit, not from anything I've seen, but just general discourse when this movie comes up, especially amongst men. This movie comes up and they go, oh, dude, you're going to get a weird boner or something about, you know, Jessica Rabbit. Or just like, oh, my first crush was an animated character, and it was Jessica Rabbit. Like, these are the things I've heard. So I was, you know, I don't know what I was expecting. Now it makes sense that of course would also be an animated character, but this is all I knew into it. So everything was kind of a surprise to me.
That's awesome.
That makes me happy to hear it, that it defied your expectations, that it was very different. That's always kind of one of the best experiences, right?
This is just kind of a stupid sentence, but it was totally different. And not in the way I was expecting. There was like a triple negative for me, where it's like, this isn't what I thought, and that's not what I thought. But because it's not what I thought, this movie, I have no idea what this movie is. So I was just spinning in space for a while trying to figure out what was going on.
Edwin, you had seen this movie before. What's your experience with it, and what do you think of it?
I mean, I love this movie. This is a movie that I watched a lot when I was a kid, which maybe I think is okay, but it feels kind of strange watching it back later. And it was a VHS and the stack of VHS tapes that we could watch from time, you know, as a kid when you had, at least when I was, now I'm making myself sound really old, or I feel really old, but
no.
Spinning the same on repeat playlist of VHS tapes throughout an entire childhood, you know? So it's a movie that I grew up really loving. I remember the ride. And you know, it's funny. I remember, Alex, you must not have been there, or you must not have watched with us, but on one of these times where we rented a vacation house as our group of friends, like over New Year's or a beach house or something, it was a movie that we for sure watched during the day.
Like, really?
And a lot of times on those trips, we would watch like whatever movies are in the house or a bad movie or whatever's playing. And there's one where I specifically remember rewatching Who Framed Roger Rabbit for the first time in a really long time and absolutely loving it again. So
one of those years we watched World Trade Center starring Nicolas Cage. Michael Pena.
That's right. I also remember us watching Space Jam, another great
Space
movie.
Jam someone had like season 2 of Survivor on DVD. Pop that in. Whatever's at the house.
Ninja Turtles, Secret of the Ooze.
I kind of like it. I like that as a rule. That now with streaming, like Airbnbs, they have TVs with all the apps. But it should just be like whatever you got at that house is what you have to watch. Whatever old DVD or VHS. That should still
sometimes
be a rule.
Sometimes the DVD case was just empty for no reason. You have no idea where it went.
Yeah. Oh, Newsies, sweet. And then there's like a copy of an old video game in there. You're like, wow, damn it.
Right. Yeah.
I totally remember. We had We had the blue Roger Rabbit VHS cover.
Oh, I played Roger Rabbit red, dude. Charmander.
So a little about Who Framed Roger Rabbit.
Wait, Sean, what about you? What was your personal?
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
Yeah,
where'd your relationship with this movie? Yeah.
I just like Edwin, I watched it hundreds of times as a child, and somehow all the jokes kind of went over my head. I mean, it's funny, like, just to recap for people maybe who haven't watched it recently, there's alcoholism, sex, murder, you know, there's all kinds of crime, like blackmail and things like guns and there's a lot of seedy characters. It's and the end is very scary, I would say.
Yeah.
A fascist judicial system. All kinds of things to be scared of. Mm-hmm. You know what this movie
is? Eyes turn into knives.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, that was.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it really is not for kids, but somehow maybe little jokes like, say, Eddie, is that a rabbit in your pocket? Or are you just happy to see me? Like, you know, you wouldn't get that as a kid. So it's just
You know what I thought the comp for this movie, the best comp? Walking out after I saw this is like, this feels like a Shrek for the generation before. In terms of
totally.
Like,
it's
big
the beginning
animated hit, and also like for kids, for parents that bring their kids to the movie, there's something for them, there's something for their kids. Cause like, when you have all the Looney Tunes in this movie, it's for kids. Like, there's some, like, all of it is, it's fun to watch the animation, but like, yes, they give a lot for adults to like as well. It's a really hard tightrope to walk, but a few movies have done it really well, and this felt like Shrek, and this movie knock it out of the park.
This is the beginning of that. Like, I think that Roger Rabbit, you can kind of, you know, you can see in its, you know, origin that like it really is kind of one of the first times that the studios like blended that, you know, adult humor with you know, kids stuff, which is animation.
I also think that this movie, I actually think like this, the all the characters appearing on screen together, I think might have been something for the like for the older generation as well. Like, yes, the cartoons have tons of kid appeal, but
like,
know,
Betty
one thing
Boop
about
showing
this movie,
up,
yeah,
yeah. Well, just they all appear together. Mickey Mouse and Bugs Bunny in the same scene talking to each other. Like, I imagine for I grew up watching a lot of Looney Tunes and things like that, but so did my parents and other people, you know, older generations. And I think there was probably a lot to appreciate in the cartoon crossover.
That's something too, that like the Muppets had been doing for decades, where like so much of the charm of the Muppets and the magic of the Muppets comes from the fact that they're practical puppets. And those are often, you know, real people are in Muppets movies. They've been doing that for a while. This felt like the first time I'd seen something that got to that level of quality of like of a Muppet movie. I mean, blending animation, I'm sure it's an entirely different beast than doing puppetry. Both have their own challenges and rewards, but like, man, this felt like a Muppet movie in terms of one, you know, a couple main human characters surrounded by an entire cast that shows up all at the same time often, in these sort of big set piece numbers.
They
sing songs. It had some Muppet energy, but they were able to kind of like the action sequences you wouldn't really see in a Muppet movie like this one.
I think too, the cartoon tone, it like balances out the real human violence that we see. It softens a lot of the actual things that we see. I think to get back to what you're saying, Sean, about the things that maybe as kids maybe went over our heads, because it's all grounded in this cartoon world where anything is possible,
that
and
we're very
the only
familiar
dangerous
with
thing is
yeah.
the dip yeah the only dangerous yeah. thing is the dip, and everything else is plates breaking on heads and pianos falling out of windows and just insanity.
Yeah, I so like I said, I watched this as much as a kid. I watched it recently, and that's what sort of inspired me to do it for the podcast, because it also is just such an interesting movie when you look into the backstory and how they made it. Who Framed Roger Rabbit? It came out in 1988. It's important to mention that the production companies were Touchstone Pictures, which was Disney, Amblin Entertainment, which is Steven Spielberg. And it was directed by Robert Zemeckis. You guys know that name?
Oh, yeah.
Of course, yeah.
Yeah, he did Forrest Gump, Back to the Future.
So many
which had already come out by the time this movie was released. The budget was $50 million, and it made $350 million at the box office, so it was a big hit. Roger Rabbit is based off of a book called Who Censored Roger Rabbit? So Gary K. Wolf was the writer of that. He was inspired by cereal commercials at the time. Had a lot of cartoons talking to people in real life. And he was like, it's really interesting because everybody treats it as totally normal. Like that Tony the Tiger is there. Like they just like are having a conversation with him about how great the cereal is. Like, you know, it's like, and so.
In conversation with Tony the Tiger.
Yeah. He wants to talk about one thing and one thing only. How good is cereal?
I mean, they're pretty good. They're great.
He's the worst podcast guest ever.
Yeah. That's what he's review on everything. But
that mixed with his love of crime novels, he came up with this idea. The book is completely different from the movie. Roger Rabbit is the one who's murdered early on.
Oh.
There's all kinds of little things that he wrote into the reality of that world too, like Roger Rabbit's actually the star of a comic strip in the book, and he talks. He has talk bubbles. So when he's murdered, they find his talk bubble at the scene of the crime, so they know his final words. It's really wild. There's a magic genie. There's all kinds of crazy stuff in there. I was watching this documentary on YouTube that I really highly recommend people go check out if they're interested. The Complicated History of Who Framed Roger Rabbit by Yesterworld Entertainment. It really gets into depth about, like, you know, somebody at Disney fell in love with the script, and then, you know, there's all this like back and forth politics, and, you know, they got Steven Spielberg involved just so that he could help them sort of like make the deals with like Bugs Bunny and getting Bugs Bunny and Mickey Mouse on screen at the same time. That was kind of one of the things that he helped get permission to do.
I didn't even think about that.
Yeah, yeah. I read that the arrangement was that they had to be on screen for the exact same amount of time.
Right. So if you think about it, that's exactly what happens when they're parachuting. Oh. They're on either side of him, taking up the same amount of the screen. They both have like back and forth lines, and then they're just, you know, they're out together. So,
and at the end, they're in that they're in that ensemble montage kind of together, but they're both very, very prominent. Yeah.
So, yeah. Cause at first, like they wanted to have all like basically every big animated character you can think of was written into the script, and they were just getting no's from everybody, like including their own studios. Like,
right. Cause we're talking like Disney and Warner Brothers at the time. Like it wasn't
right. Right. There was bad blood there because Looney Tunes was originally like just a ripoff of Mickey Mouse cartoons. And like they had like some Fox character who looked just like Mickey Mouse. Like, and then they got in trouble with Disney. That's how they went on to develop Looney Tunes. That's how they went on to, there was a animator named Tex Avery who invented the like cartoon violence, sort of like smashing people's heads with a frying pan and all the kind of like stuff you'd see in a Wile E. Coyote cartoon.
Will say that the cartoon violence in this movie, it made me laugh in a way that I wasn't expecting a lot of times.
Yeah, same.
Like what specifically?
For whatever reason, the scene where he's like, I think Roger's like, I'm trying to remember exactly when this happens, but I think he says, I watch you, Eddie, I got you. I'm on backup. And he like is walking around and he's talking to himself and he gets hit in the head with the frying pan. For whatever reason, that really made me laugh. Like I thought it was.
Yeah.
Yeah. I really loved the exchange of physics between like the real world and Toontown, where just like
yeah
the things that, ha- yeah, like when Valiant falls off that building and like his he falls and then his hat goes down. I like yeah, that when you're in Toontown that happens.
Yeah, that's so true. Or when the elevator goes up and he's just like flat on the floor. Yeah. Yeah.
And then likewise for the tunes that were in like the real world where it's like they have to like they bump up against real physics. You know, and everyone's like, ah, you can hurt the tunes. They're fine. Like, you can do whatever you want to them.
It's worth mentioning that Richard Williams Animation did the animation for this movie, and they hunted this guy down after going through a lot of different animation departments. And he eventually made The Thief and the Cobbler, if you know that.
Oh, wow. Yeah, I haven't thought about that in a really long time.
Right. So he's just to say that, like, Richard Williams is a genius when it comes to animation. And they got the best.
Now, really quick, I've held off on, like, I didn't want to research this movie a bunch, but right before. I left that to you, Sean, the host. Did this movie, like, win awards? Like, was it a critically respected movie? Because I really haven't really looked it up.
That is a good question.
It did win some awards.
It won a lot of awards. Just Oscars. It won Best Film Editing, Best Sound Effects Editing, Best Visual Effects. Of course.
Oh, that does not surprise. Sound effects. That is awesome. I noticed that in the movie, how awesome the sound design is.
And they gave a special achievement award to Richard Williams, the animator.
Oh, wow.
The animation director. They got nominated for Best Art Direction, Best Cinematography, and Best Sound.
I believe this movie was critically very well loved.
It was a hit. It was definitely a hit, and it was really popular. Other movies that came out this year: Die Hard,
heard of it?
Big,
heard of it?
Heathers, Rain Man, Twins, Cocktail, A Fish Called Wanda, The Naked Gun, Earth Girls Are Easy.
Wow.
Also, Akira and Totoro came out this year.
Whoa, Akira! What a year! Also, the year I was born. I mean, come on.
Oh, happy birthday.
Thanks, man. man, I happened to rewatch A Fish Called Wanda over the holidays.
Dude, that's a good movie.
It's not. Edwin, have you seen it? When's the last time you saw it, dude?
Oh, okay.
I haven't.
It was really hard to get through. It was so bad. I mean, Sean, and I know if movies do not age well, you are not on board. And oh my God, that movie.
I guess I've forgotten. Yeah.
So bad.
Maybe that's a reason to watch one for this podcast.
Yeah. Kevin Kline won Best Supporting Actor. And I was like, you got to be kidding me.
I also just want to shout out.
Rain Man and Twins came out in the same year.
Yeah.
What a year for duos. For zany duos. Here's Rain Man, this like serious Oscar movie about autism and siblings.
And twins.
And then here's Danny DeVito and Schwarzenegger in Twins.
Twin. One's big and one's small.
You like Rain Man? You're going to love Twins. It's awesome.
I also just want to mention Bob Hoskins, the star of Eddie Valiant, who, like, he doesn't have. I didn't see a ton of movies that I'd was familiar with, but Mario in Super Mario Bros. The original, and Shmi in Hook.
Mm-hmm.
That's Shmi. Yeah. I was like, man, this guy. He's familiar in some way, and I was like, he must have been a known actor at the time to get this role. It's a huge role. Smee. Okay. All right. From Hook. Click in now.
That kind of is. I mean, I think we'll as we you go, we funny? Can continue to talk about. Oh, go ahead.
Sorry, a quick one that I had to double check real quick. But I remember in high school we watched a Shakespeare play, like a tape of a Shakespeare play. and Bob Hoskins was in it. I don't remember what role it was, but it was this very funny realization that he's Eddie from Who Framed Roger Rabbit. It was like a British man playing a Shakespearean character. It was really, really funny.
That kind of it concludes my backstory on the movie.
I have one extra piece of info for you.
Yeah.
The German name for Who Framed Roger Rabbit, because I'm in Switzerland, and when I Google it, it comes up like the suggested results all the time, is Falschenspiel mit Roger Rabbit, which translates directly to wrong play with Roger Rabbit.
Wrong play.
Yeah.
This episode is supported by FX's Clipped, the scandalous story of the 2014 Clippers owner's racist remarks captured on tape and heard around the world. The series charts the tape's impact on a dysfunctional basketball organization striving to win against their reputation as the most cursed team in the league. Starring Lawrence Fishburne, Jackie Weaver, Cleopatra Coleman, and Ed O'Neill. FX's Clipped, streaming June 4th, only on Hulu.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
This is Amy Poehler. My new movie, Disney and Pixar's Inside Out 2, is coming to theaters June 14th, and it's making me feel joy. Woo! And sadness. Oh. And anger. Definitely some disgust.
Rose!
And I think a little fear.
Really?
But I'm also feeling these new emotions like anxiety, embarrassment, envy, and ennui.
It's what you call the boredom.
Okay, that one was weird. It's going to be the feel-everything movie of the summer. Disney and Pixar's Inside Out 2, only in theaters June 14th. Get tickets now.
Before we go on to just kind of talk about the rest of the movie, I think we were going to introduce a new segment here where we'll do the Dundee, our Dundies for the movie. After we go over a little backstory, and nod to our other podcast, the Michael Scott Podcast Company. If you like The Office, go check that out.
These are our roots. These are a shout out to our roots. And I'll say too, a Dundee is, we would define it as an award you may or may not want to win.
Yes. My Dundee for Who Framed Roger Rabbit goes to Bob Hoskins for Best American Accent. I had no idea that he is very British.
Well, this is a good... Okay, hey, I had no idea. That's crazy that he's...
Yeah.
So this has been happening for a long time, because now every movie is like, oh yeah, there's not an American actor in that movie. And you're like, really? This took place in like Alabama in the 70s. It's like, nope, all Australian, all British. That's crazy, because the choice to make this movie, and it makes a lot more sense. I didn't realize this is based off a book, but I was like, the choice to make this set in 1940s Hollywood was really interesting, because I was like, oh, this came out in 1988. It's going to take place in the 80s. So I didn't even know it took place in the 40s. Which is even harder for, I would feel like, an English actor to get that accent of like that era of the American dialect. And then the whole movie just... like, it never felt cheesy that it was as like this film noir. It actually, I think it helped soften the edges between like the real life and the animation. You know, the fact that he was this sort of noir detective, it kind of let him play it as a cartoon almost of like a noir detective. I think it probably helped with an English actor just like, hey, go over the top here.
Yeah, I mean, I think Edwin, exactly. He's a Shakespearean actor, and that's kind of what you need for Who Framed Roger Rabbit, because a lot of the times he is not acting with anything in front of him. There's just people all around the set just pulling fish wire to, like, Roger hits a fan and like a bunch of papers go everywhere. Like, that's just kind of like when you see the clips without the animation in it, it's just Bob Hoskins talking to nothing. And I mean, and he just does an incredible job. And I'm sure that it was, they were very technical with, you know, where he has to be looking. There were storyboards that were made for everything. ahead of time. So not only it's hitting your mark is much more specific and much more important in this. So yeah, I think you needed a great Shakespearean actor like Bob Hoskins.
It is very funny to think of him interacting with all these different characters. All the time he's grabbing Roger Rabbit and pulling him close. At the end, he gives him the big kiss. All these times that he has to play with the cartoon world is so funny when you think about like all the different things you got to do. Like holding at the end when he's holding the mallet with that has the boxing glove. He's got to like exaggerate all of these moments, and he has to react when he's getting hit by cartoons and all these different things. It's very funny to think about that. But yeah, he plays it over the top, but in a way that is necessary for this role in this movie.
Totally. Yeah. You have to. And I mean, what was the name of the animator you said? It was something Williams?
Richard Williams.
Richard Williams. I mean, the fact that if they truly did have to really like hunt him down and be like, this is the guy. I mean, that was a great call. That was a good investment by the people that made the movie, because I like you, Edwin, I kept rewinding little bits just to be, because I was like, the lines got really blurry between what was the practical world and what was animation in a way that was like, shout out to them pulling this off in the 80s. Because like, like you said, there are times when he would throw Roger Rabbit or something would get thrown into like, in the warehouse, into a bunch of boxes or something. And the way that the actual boxes, the way they had them like explode all out and like all the real props that he was interacting with, really just it worked so well. I was so impressed with the technical side of this movie, and like even the green screen, like the fact that the animations, they looked like just a tiny bit extra fuzzy, it actually really worked. I don't know if that makes sense, but like it wasn't really sharp HD, and the fact that they almost had this ghost like quality that I thought really actually helped the overall effect.
Everything you just said was just so highly deliberate, and they specifically were like the cartoons need to interact with the physical world as much as possible. The weasels are always holding real guns, which are being puppeted from above by a guy with a wire, and they built all kinds of little robots and things like that for like, you know, Roger taking a shot and then throwing the shot glass. Like that's like a custom robot just for that one little part. Disney was not really doing well at the time. They made like the Black Cauldron was kind of one of their biggest movies. It was kind of a flop. And they had done like Pete the Dragon, where like Pete just kind of looks like, you know, pasted onto the screen. They were aware through failures basically that like they had to do something that really looked different and believable, so they put a lot of effort into the puppeting, drawing the animation in a way that actually like interacts with the lighting. So like they would like, you know, if Roger walks under a lamp, like the lighting, like he's lit in a way, like they had to draw that in, or they drew in shadows and things like that. It's wild.
I was so impressed by that. Yeah. Very cool.
It's really, really cool. And then what was the last thing you said? Another point to make, but
I'm not sure. Oh, like the way they looked, like the kind of ghostly quality to the,
oh yeah. That was also another thing where they were like using like haze when they would photograph the, you know, the glass plates that they do the animation on, they would like they like use some different filming techniques specifically so that it would look like the characters were there in real life.
It really did look cool. I mean, when you first see Jessica Rabbit, we should probably talk about that scene. That seems to be the marquee scene of this movie. But the way that she looks was so like, she is like a dream, like this. She's almost sparkling. There's all these effects to her that is like sort of in the eye of the beholder for the people that are at that club, you know, watching the show, where it's just like, I don't know if this person is real or not. And I think that's sort of the effect she was meant to have on people.
Yeah, there is like a blurriness, a fuzziness that sort of, I think, helps. I think if this movie were made today, it feels like they would almost be too sharp. They would go in the opposite direction. And the characters and the cartoons might seem too crisp and too animated. It almost, right. it would,
Because they'd use a computer or something to.
Yeah, it feels like it would dip into Uncanny Valley territory if they tried to make this movie today. They would totally. Make it like too realistic and yeah.
We saw this with, I mean, the new. Okay, so my other frame of reference for live action and animation is Space Jam, the first Space Jam, yeah. in like 96, and that did sure. a pretty good job, but I would say like not as good of a job as this movie in terms of like when they interact with the cartoons. It felt a little more real in this movie for some reason than it did in Space Jam. And then go to the new Space Jam that came out a couple years ago, where it was just this assault on the senses. Talk about overproduced. I just was like, I don't know where, like, what world are we in? Nothing is real enough, and also nothing is fake enough. So I'm like, this, it just was caught between the two worlds in a way that this movie intentionally was like, there's Toontown, there's here. And we're going to explore what relationship would actually exist between the humans and the toons. This movie asked a lot more interesting questions than any, like, in a way that made the animation interacting with the humans totally made sense. As opposed to, you know, Space Jam, it's just like the aliens come in and they kidnap them and they take them to their planet that's toons. This is like, no, here on Earth, there is a portal to Toontown. And likewise, yeah. and we bleed Tunnel. Into each other's worlds. And
you can just drive there.
You can just drive
through the big red curtain.
I think a piece of that too might be that Bob Hoskins is better at doing this kind of acting than like Charles Barkley and Michael Jordan.
That's huge.
No, shade whatsoever to MJ, Charles, everyone else in that movie. But you know, and inside the NBA, sometimes they play back that clip of Charles Barkley getting taken over by the alien, and they kind of laugh about it.
It's pretty good.
Like Bob Hoskins does such a crazy yeah. job interacting with all the. Again, yeah. we've talked about this already, but yeah,
yeah, that's good.
It brings the movie to life.
Did you guys? What about your Dundies?
Yeah, Alex? I got a Dundee here. This is Dundee for the best use of artificial intelligence / dystopian weapon. This is an award to the AI revolver that I am, the gun that Valiant uses.
Smart bullets.
Towards the, when I saw this, I was like, oh my God, this movie invented artificial intelligent weapons. What an incredible advancement. Jumping 40 years ahead in the future to bullets that have smart, or guns that have smart bullets that can talk to you, that know you by name, that will do your bidding.
But much like current AI, it's only as good as how you direct it.
This is why I gave this award. Is he at one point he shoots the bullets?
Dum-dums.
Yeah, and Judge Doom, or that goes one way, and they're like, "Which way did he go?" They don't know. It's like we're not quite there with AI. Almost, I can still tell the pictures are fake, but
dude, that part is so.
The
sick
hand has too many fingers. Yeah, it's always like little things like that. Yeah.
Yeah, so best use of AI.
So great when he brings out the box and like open, like it's so like he throws the bottle up in the air and then just like
I know the bullets jump into his gun, like let's go. I was a little disturbed by the whole. It was just a little bit like, whoa, this is kind of crazy. What are we saying about America here? But that the reason I want to bring this award up is just because exploring this. Class thing between the toons and the humans was really interesting part of it. And I don't know if that's sort of what was meant by this movie, but to me, when he brings that gun out is sort of the moment where the two become intertwined. And sort of from that point on, once he goes into Toontown, you really get to sort of explore the themes for this movie throughout, or like why do humans treat toons the way they do? I mean, Roger Rabbit is just getting beat up at work all the time. No one seems to care. That's just like, these are the point of toons. It's almost like,
I'm not worried about you. I'm worried about the refrigerator.
Exactly. It's like no, they want to work. They're happy when they work. Look at them. And sort of that, when he sort of uses the toon technology on his side, it seems to flip. I just kind of wanted to explore that idea that we see in the movie. And maybe this is a good time to talk about Judge Doom as well, because we haven't really talked about this character that is whoa, oh my God, terrifying.
I think one little thing that maybe plays on this this relationship is some of the funnier moments in the movie to me came when Roger Rabbit was speaking up and being very serious, and he's, I'm not going to try to do the voice, but he says, "Just a second, I have to express my moral outrage," when he thinks that he's holding them all up with the gun before they drop the ton of bricks on him. at the end. Like, it's very funny sometimes when he's saying things that are very honest and earnest. He's like, I've got something to say, but yeah. It's, you know, yeah, yeah.
The ton of bricks, that reminds me too, there's just a lot of, this movie has a lot of fun sort of tipping its hat to the audience and being like, yep, this is zany old cartoons. Like, it's like they can't help but do these old cartoon tropes that we all know so well. I mean, that's even what Judge Doom uses to apprehend Roger Rabbit the first time, which is he does the shave and a haircut. And Roger Rabbit can't help no bust out of the wall and go, Doom, it's like... There's this leverage that humans have over tunes where they're like, we know exactly how they behave and why they do it. So when Doom showed up with his dip, that was so scary, man. He is an all-time villain. Yeah. Like, Judge Doom is terrifying.
He just kills that little shoe.
Dude,
I know. That's the thing. It really, yeah.
That was like terrifying. That was like the Green Mile, like watching this thing be put to death slowly. I was like, oh my God, this is like, as a kid, what did you guys, just seeing that as a child, I mean, that must have been scarring. A shoe that's like, no! And it's like sizzled to death in this dip. Mm-hmm.
And horrifying. Then they show it on the liquid, just like the red.
God.
You got to remember, we were still watching cartoons like Bambi. like we'd seen some horrible things.
I guess so.
I can think of a number of cartoon movies that had like scary parts, and I would watch them anyway, but like, oh, we got to the scary part.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And this was one of those, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like, mm-hmm. You watch the rest of the movie, be like, oh, we got the scary part.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. That whole scene when the head of Acme has been murdered, you get the police going through all the gags. They got they introduce the hole in the wall. You can just slap it up on the wall and awesome. And then Eddie uses it later to get out of the magnet.
It's awesome. Yeah,
that's the funny thing about this whole interaction and this, like, how do the humans control or create the cartoons? Because if you think about it, the toons are actually these all powerful beings. They can do anything. They can, like, crush things in the physical world.
Only when
they have,
it's funny.
Yeah. But only when it's funny. I guess that's true. Yeah.
Yeah.
They're kind of like house elves in Harry Potter. It's kind of the allegory I thought of. I know, Edwin, you're not a Harry Potter head, but the house elves are like extraordinarily magic, powerful beings, but they've sort of just been cast as, that's where I sort of got the idea of like, no, they want to work. They're only happy when they work for us. Mm-hmm. Yet they kind of have incredible magic in them that they don't really use because they don't need to. But that's how I felt about the toons. I had that thought, Edwin. Yeah, like, yeah, if the toons revolt, they could just take over the earth pretty easily.
Take over the world. Like. Yeah.
Like, humans look pretty fragile compared to them. You know, and I guess Judge Doom, that character, serves as the sort of like, what if a toon figured this out? As we learn.
He's the anyway. Toon. He's the toon that murdered Eddie's brother.
Yeah. Oh my God, that was probably the best line. My favorite moment in the whole movie, by the way, was just that, the film noir shot where when Valiant's drinking in the bar and it's like, they're like, what's wrong with him, or why is he so uptight? And he's like, Toon killed his brother. I laughed so hard at the way that line was delivered. And it was so silly. Toon killed his brother. Loved it.
And there's something funny too, that it's like, every toon knows that if a toon's in trouble, you gotta go to Valiant. Yeah.
Right. Yeah, I love Eddie. I love that. That's right. Yeah, Eddie was you know, everyone in Toontown knows him. Everyone. Yeah.
Even when he's recounting the day of the murder, he says, we're chasing a bank robbery. He's stolen a zillion simoleons.
Yeah. First National Bank of Toontown.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's great. It was awesome.
Dropped a piano on us from 15 stories.
Yeah. It's like it's so funny the way that it blurs together. Yeah. And so I think it's funny too, to think that as a kid or kids watching this movie, it's funny to be introduced to the tropes of like noir through a movie like this. I also remember like a Garfield story that I read as a kid that had all these noir elements to it and stuff. And it's just very funny to think that something that is, it's so different from the cartoon world, which is probably why they were brought together in the first place. Or as you explained, Sean, that is why kind of they were brought together in the first place. But it's just such a funny two different tropes and storytelling methods brought together. Like, there's the intense seriousness and the complete ridiculousness all together.
Yeah, it's that is really one thing that's, they came up with rules for this world and they stick to And it just like they took like the kind of like the Tex Avery like cartoon violence and kind of made it like legitimately dangerous, like mm-hmm. is really fun and weird. Edwin, do you have a Dundee that you'd like to share?
Thank you. I do. I have two. And I don't know if you have more, but the first one I have is best supporting accessory, and it goes to Eddie Valiant's tie.
Oh my
I love Eddie's tie. It's like so too bad. Short.
So fat.
And it makes him, I can think of other examples. I'm thinking of Donkey Kong and then Charlie from It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia when they have the short, wide tie. Yeah. And it's so funny. Like, it's such an off. It really, but it also is like an element. Like, you can pull the tie and grab the tie. I think when he's with RK Maroon, the tie is in this, I don't remember what
he puts it in
typewriter or something like that. And it gets stuck in the rolls.
It's whatever they were watching. Like, he was watching a film on it earlier in the movie.
You're right. They're rewatching the film reels. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, gotta love it. And then, mm-hmm. another newsreel. Yeah, mm-hmm. Cloverleaf buys the Red Line. In case you didn't know, this movie is loosely based on a conspiracy about getting rid of public transportation to support freeways. Yeah,
yeah,
and also paving over, you know, like neighborhoods to build freeways, also, which Portland has a terrible history with.
Oh, sure.
But the other thing that I'm thinking of is that scene where Jessica Rabbit shows up at Eddie Valiant's office and he comes out of the bathroom and he's just wearing his tie, but no shirt underneath. And then I think he puts on a shirt after that.
And then his pants fall down.
Hairy guy.
It's just very funny to see a man with no shirt and a tie on. Like, I don't know why that's so silly. Yeah. Yeah.
It's the inverse of the Porky Pig. Mm-hmm. It's, t-shirt, like a shirt and nothing else. It's just nothing but a tie or a top.
There's like a seriousness and like a there are so many pieces that are involved in his outfit. Like the hat and the tie and the shirt and the jacket and the pants. It's very funny that he's got like this whole collected ensemble when he's running around fighting crime.
Fighting crime.
Yeah.
I mean, the noir part of it is just makes this movie work so much because like inherently I feel like in that noir genre it's a little bit campy, it's a little bit it's so stylized, but if you're gonna have cartoons in your movie, it just like that was just the good move to go with that kind of film noir look. And like I say too, having Valiant be like a legitimate alcoholic, and that comes up several times throughout the movie, I mean, it doesn't let you forget about the human problems, even though we're dealing with cartoons so much. I really like that about the movie. And like Eddie's, he's kind of lonely. He lost his brother. Yeah. He's like an alcoholic.
Like, it's real grief. Like there's
he used
real,
to have a good thing with Dolores. He's going through the old pictures.
It's like he's a really tragic
and Dolores
person.
Is just waiting for him to kind of like pull himself together.
Yeah. I really like that it would have been easy to do this movie and just, hey, here's the hard-boiled detective. We don't need to know about him. But I like that they took some time to, like, you know, what problems are humans having? What problems are toons having? How do we mix them? I really liked it. I think one of the best scenes in the movie was when Valiant gets home, I think, and they sort of, without any words, they sort of tell the story of him and his brother, of the background, through some old clips, through, like, some stuff. I thought that was just really clever, really touching way to kind of give the exposition on his character without him. You know, he could have been at a bar and being like, you know, my brother, and give a whole speech. But I like that it's sort of just this lonely, quiet scene where you just pan around his room and you get to learn, like, why does he hate tunes? Because that's a big part of this, is him getting over his own, like, bias.
Dude, this is just like what I mean. This movie is just it's a movie. It's a it's very Hollywood. It's got, I mean, they show rather than tell. They put a lot of work into the sets and the set pieces and stuff like that. I mean, it's just like stuff like that really makes the movie so good. And you wouldn't see, I feel like, just like we were saying, if they made this movie today, they wouldn't put so much effort into the details like that. Mm-hmm. I think
one thing that makes me think of as well is we talked about the cartoon craziness and how they can kind of do anything with anything as long as it's funny and these properties of the real world don't apply to them. It's very funny to watch that contrast that he gets, not just the noir styling, but the sort of technology or the things that they use. Like when Eddie is figuring out about the will, he sees through the, he uses a magnifying glass to look at a picture in a newspaper.
Yeah.
And like they're always a
computer enhanced.
Yeah. Yeah. It's so funny that he's literally using a magnifying glass in the newspaper to do his detective work.
Yeah.
When all this insane possibility exists with the cartoons.
Edwin, you said you had a second Dundee.
I do, and it's for best surprise cartoon ending, and it goes to the train taking out the Dipmobile at the end of the movie.
Which basically probably might have happened either way.
The Dipmobile.
Well, it's very funny that rewatching this movie, it's probably been, I would guess, somewhere between 5 and 10 years since I've seen this movie last. And I remember a lot of it from watching it a lot as a kid, but I didn't remember every little beat.
Yeah.
And there'd be scenes where I'd be like, all right, I think this is going to happen next. Right. Okay. This and this. All right. I remember this part. I remember this line. I remember this scene, et cetera. And then as the Dipmobile, as I affectionately called it, it was like streaming out towards Toontown at the end of the movie. I remember thinking to myself, how did they get rid of this again? And then it's just, and it really made me laugh. And I was like, all right, there you go. That's it. That's it.
I was scared in that moment. I thought he was accidentally was going to flood Toontown with all that dip. It was just going to seep in like a contaminant from a oil spill or something and just kill all the crops in Toontown. But it didn't.
Oh, man.
I also think maybe another third minor dip delivery is, or Dundee for best single line delivery goes to Jessica Rabbit for saying, oh my God, it's Dip.
Yeah. They completely change her. Like, she's all of a sudden got like eyes.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Right. Yeah.
Right, because the entire movie, she's basically at like two angles, which is like she's like looking through one eye with her hair, like, you know, hips swinging around, or she's walking away from someone, looking back one eye with her hair. And then at that moment, you knew it was real because she lost her shit.
It's a big contrast from, I'm not bad, I'm just drawn that way.
Yeah, so, love that
one. Oh my God, it's Dip.
By the way, were Jessica Rabbit and the baby, were they like the only humans, like toon humans? Is there a subgenre of, because most of the toons are animals. So it's like, it's just it's a weird gray area. Like, what's the politics of toons that are people?
In the opening cartoon, also, you see the mom's legs. And then when Roger is leaving the stage, it's revealed that there's a man on stilts with the legs on.
Cartoon legs.
Yeah. So that's not even a person. Yeah.
Also Raul J. Raul. What an amazing
I did
Raul,
like that.
Film director.
Yeah. Unbelievable.
Yeah. Look, stars.
Raul.
I'm ready for
callbacks. A lot of great callbacks in this movie. You mentioned the little gag with the hole, you slap a hole and then you can
I
loved that. And then it also ends where it started with the hand buzzers, like kind of the back to basics when we first meet Acme before he's murdered. He does the hand buzzer thing at the party. He's got all the tricks on
number one seller.
And it's I love that stuff's really bothering Valiant, where he's just like, I'm so tired of this. And then at the end he hits the buzzer, he's got the hand buzzer on, and he's sort of like, you know, hey, Eddie found his old self, his old sense of humor, his old, you know, he believes in magic.
Again. Roger does it to him, and then he gives him a big smooch.
Big old kiss. and everyone, like, turtles up after he hits him with the hand buzzer, Roger.
Yeah.
And he's like, nah, I like jokes now, guys. Love jokes.
Not I love the way that Bob anymore. Hoskins acts out the hand buzzer, too. He really, really sells it.
There are
some
incredible moments of humans selling the animation. Number one, this is my backup Dundee for best salesman. To Christopher Lloyd, in the scene when he does capture Robert Rabbit and he's about to put him in the dip, and then Eddie's like, no, you should drink this. Let's give him one last drink. No, I really... Yes, you do. No, I don't. They go back and forth. Drinks the whiskey, and as he's shaking before his like head explodes, there's a shot of Christopher Lloyd, you know, all black gloves, and he's supposed to be holding Roger Rabbit's neck, and he's just going like, Yeah. He's doing the craziest shake job. And I'm like, give that man his paycheck. Good for him.
When you know too that Christopher Lloyd is a toon, you realize like his acting throughout the movie has been so strange.
Yeah.
Like he's like the way he moves and like he's like you know his expression changes like really fast.
It looks
and, like
he's wearing a
it's
prosthetic.
Like, oh, he's trying,
even though he's not. The whole time I was like, that's Christopher Lloyd, right? And I wasn't
100%
sure.
His makeup is kind of making him look a little bit more like he's like, you know, a pale like cartoon villain. Yeah.
It's funny at the end when they look down at his remains or the remains of the clothes and the face and everything. And I think Eddie Valiant says it was a rubber mask. Like to imagine it was actually a cartoon and rubber mask. You like it would actually be like, like Christopher Lloyd, so he speaks so clearly, you know. Has anyone seen a rabbit? Like he's but if it was really a cartoon in a rubber mask, how would that have sounded?
It's toon technology. Don't worry about
it. It is toon technology.
Did they pitch Christopher Lloyd's voice up a little bit?
Yeah.
Okay. Because I was like, that's not
at the end.
But I thought the whole movie, I was like, that's a little higher than Christopher Lloyd's voice. And maybe it's because he was filled with helium the whole time. I don't know. But it was like they had a something. I don't know. It was just like a little bit different. Because I mean, I think Christopher Lloyd got to be one of Zemeckis' guys after Back to the Future.
That's
only
right.
A few years before.
That's right.
Before he found Tom Hanks and was like, now I only work with Tom Hanks. but this was like I don't know. I was a big. I thought Judge Doom is another reason this movie succeeds. Outside of Hoskins' acting performance and then this general technical achievement of the cartoons, like that having that villain grounded the whole movie in a really good way. And it's I didn't even think about it, Sean. You're right. With the sunglasses, the hat, the cloak. I think it's and rewatching a couple scenes. For instance, when Valiant spills the dip and gets away with Roger Rabbit after the scene I just said, the way that Doom looks at the dip and backs up from it. Is you realize, he's really afraid of that as much as anyone.
Right. Yeah.
Because but we learn later the dip doesn't really hurt humans. I mean, Valiant's wading through it like he's in a creek at the end of the movie.
Yeah.
So all that was just like this character was so interesting and had so many layers. And yeah, like you said, just delivered the scariness of a villain that like we have to be against something.
I also love his weasels. That's just every time they drive a real car that they're always crashing.
I just like how
I just love that.
They're all in different colored zoot suits and they're all slinky and they all got a little like they're just
stop that laughing.
I would hang
out
with
really
the
funny to watch them
for sure.
To watch them in the early scene where they park the car really poorly on the street, like it's very funny to see somebody park the car like that and then just get like, it's always fishtailing around the streets.
Yeah. I did like the. I love the weasels.
Yeah.
Great gang. Great gang to be a part of.
And I mean, when they are in his apartment and he's like got Roger in the sink, Eddie Valiant, dude, that scene is so good. And that has so much going on. Like the guns are like, you know, they're puppeteering the guns. There's all this water stuff going on, like the weasel splashing him and like drags the chair around and gets it's just like they have so much fun with the weasels and their whole scene where they're just dying one by one. I absolutely love that.
The little little ghosts coming.
They're all laughing to death.
Again, kind of scary watching them all die. Just being like, yeah, they're dying. This is harsh, man.
But they become little angels.
Yeah, with the little harp.
Yeah, what do they do? They become angels.
Yeah. The crazy one like hits the switch on the machine as he's like going to heaven.
How much do we want to talk about the actual mystery, the plot at all?
The plot? I mean, I think it's really interesting. Like, okay, in the book it's a murder mystery that's just about the toons and like there's not have you guys seen Chinatown?
Yeah.
No.
I'm
aware. I mean I'm aware. Yeah.
It's film noir and it's got Jack Nicholson. But like the whole backstory is like this whole thing about controlling water in LA, and like it was kind of similar with Roger Rabbit, where it's like it's all about public transportation and like destroying this like, you know, minority community in order to build a freeway, and it's like these are kind of real things that like were happening, you know, throughout American history, and or at least in the 1900s, and like it again really grounded the movie and raised the stakes, I think.
I mean that it makes sense for when the movie's set, right? In like 1947. This is right at the dawn of the suburban, like the golden era of, or when suburbia basically came around to exist. Going into the 50s, in this period of like hyper American wealth and stability, and it's sort of this age when everyone could have a car, everyone could have a house, and everyone moved out to the suburbs. They got created. So this was very much this would have been a real issue in the late 40s, early 50s, where we're saying, hey, we want to create this road. We got to build it somewhere. And this is, you know, this whole movie centers around the Toons getting control of their own community. It's like, hey, can we give, maybe the decisions about what happens here should come from the community itself. This is something that is still an issue today. all over this country. So, you know, good on the movie for not, you know, kind of going right at that. I don't know what, in the late 80s, I don't know what the discourse was around this. I could imagine something similar with just sort of the expansion of materialism. I think the 80s were probably next to the 50s in terms of times when things just exponentially compounded in that arena. And this movie kind of wrestles with that.
Yeah, I think. Oh, go ahead.
One thing, too, is that the ending of this movie, it actually, at least for me in this moment in this year, 2024, it was kind of funny when Judge Doom says, they call it a freeway with petrol stations and automobile dealerships.
Rapidly prepared food.
As far as the eye can see. Yeah, rapidly prepared food. It is very funny that like that's the grand scheme.
Right.
It's just a freeway. And you know, having lived in LA very recently, it's maybe more sad than funny, because it's very true. It's all freeways.
I know.
And public. It's not just that it's all freeways. The public transportation is not great.
He's describing a Flying J travel center with like, you know, like it's the Taj Mahal. It'll be incredible. Yeah. So shout out to Judge Doom for really, really high level bad guy explaining his plot monologue. Loved it.
Oh yeah,
really classic stuff.
Oh, yeah,
again, very much in the noir. Like someone's tied to a chair, you know?
Yeah.
And the bad guy's like, "You almost had me, but you didn't see this," and then gets his comeuppance.
And then he dies
in his own dip. Good move.
Yes. Yeah, man. I would say too. Like, I will say, just one criticism of the movie is that I kind of wish Doom turned into a cartoon in the end. The weird like eyes that they animate over Christopher Lloyd and that crazy hair and stuff like that. I think it was a missed opportunity to draw something very scary.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, it was very scary, but maybe not in the way that they intended. I mean, it was so nightmare upsetting, like the imagery of the knives and the eyes and like,
yeah,
probably what they
giant
wanted.
Like saw arm thing. Yeah,
but
well, I think too that there's I don't know if it would be more effective than what we got, which is only to say that what we got was a person who had real human evil and real cartoon abilities. And yeah. That was pretty terrifying in the moment when he makes the buzzsaw in his hand, you know?
That's true.
Yeah. But I think you're right, Sean. They could have, what if Judge Doom, when he is in his cartoon form, is, you know, bigger, scarier. Yeah, he's unleashed with all the powers of cartoon magic. I did agree with that. Yeah.
He should change many forms like an anime villain.
Yeah.
You haven't even seen my final form yet. Yeah.
While we're on criticisms, if I may throw one out there of,
sure.
I'd say my one, it's weird to say, the thing I didn't like the most about this movie, my least favorite character was Roger Rabbit. I just found him really annoying and was kind of ready for his scenes to be over as soon as they started. It was just too much. Maybe I think it was just the voice. It was just like, I just can't take a lot of that. It was just so manic every scene he was in. I get that's the, I understand that's the point. I get it. But
what is it? I'm trying to do. Please, Eddie. No, I can't do it.
Please, Eddie. Yeah.
I can't do it.
But there's,
shout out to Charles Fleischer, who is a great vocal.
I don't want to besmirch the performance and everything. It was just, it was just a lot.
That's fine. I mean, this I think that's a fair thing to say because, I mean, for someone growing up with the movie, it's that is just he's kind of like Bugs Bunny to me a little bit. Mm-hmm. There's like just somebody that I've known and watched forever, and it's funny because the thing about it with the fresh eyes or the to be watching it now, I could understand it. I will say though that like for whatever reason, some of the cartoon silliness that he did made me laugh in other ways that I wasn't expecting. Like there's a moment where he puts the handcuffs on Eddie, and I think he goes, "You're under arrest." He goes, I can't do the noise, but like, the noise that he makes with his lips, it really got me in a way that is very silly and stupid and feels like it shouldn't make me laugh in my advanced age. But yeah,
dude, I love when he's doing shaving a haircut two bits, Doom is, and then Eddie just like is like, man, I don't know who's nuttier, you or Doom. And he turns around and Roger Rabbit's like all twisted up, like trying to hold it in. And that, yeah. That's fair. But yeah, I do want to take a second to say Charles Fleischer, like was on set every day. So he would do the voice from off camera for Bob Hoskins. And then, he usually was wearing a huge Roger Rabbit suit, like with a hat that had big bunny ears. And,
I thought that was a practical joke by Robert Zemeckis.
That like, sounds the like the stuff of nightmares. Yeah.
He's like, Bob, you didn't have to wear that at all. What? It's just how Charles talks.
Man, I'll try and find this photo and send it to you guys.
I see now. I'm on the Wikipedia page now that we're doing the episode. But it looks like he also played Benny the Cab. And two members of the Toon Patrol, Greasy and Psycho.
Ah,
nice. what are those? The weasels?
I guess a couple weasels.
So. Yeah.
Also,
it was on the car. Toon Patrol. Yeah.
Kathleen Turner plays Jessica Rabbit. What a voice! I mean, sultry, wonderful, velvety voice. I think the spell that Jessica Rabbit casts was they did a very good job communicating that. And again, that was one of the only things I knew about this movie is people are like, oh my God, dude, Jessica Rabbit, first crush, you know?
Yeah, it's true.
And I was watching this movie as my wife was, she had to go to bed early because she had work super early the next day. So she just kind of made comments as she was passing by and she's seen this movie a bunch, but she was just like, the chest to hips ratio is crazy on
it
Jessica.
It's crazy. Man, there was a celebrity who did a Jessica Rabbit costume for Halloween. You know how like celebrities have been getting really into like over the top Halloween costumes? Like she had like prosthetics that made her like chest like bigger, just kind of like it is. Let me find out who did this. But yeah, she's ridiculous. And it's funny too because
I was thinking of actresses who would play the...
Oh, it's Heidi Klum, of course.
Okay. I was like, well, actresses that would play the live-action version of this, or if you flipped all the live-action with the animated characters. And I was like, who's the... Hendricks? No, from Mad Men?
Christina Hendricks.
Yeah. I was like, she could be Jessica Rabbit. I feel like she's... The red hair and like...
Definitely has very, Jessica Rabbit energy. Yeah. Any final thoughts about Who Framed Roger Rabbit?
Soundtrack.
I mean,
holy crow. Yeah. It was awesome. Like the soundtrack the whole time, because it's all an original score. And it is like, there's so much great jazz, just noir-y old jazz. It was really cool. I just had a good time kind of bopping along to the soundtrack the whole time. And then we already mentioned the sound effects. I mean, obviously it won an Academy Award. But that it is a playground of sound effects, this whole movie, because you have all the real stuff and all the animated stuff. It just was this, it was a feast for the ears the whole time.
The two last things that I are thinking of, one more, I guess, serious and one not serious at all. The serious one is that I think it is so good for the movie that it doesn't have a sequel.
Yes.
And yeah. I did some research on this movie before our conversation, but not a ton. And there was something about prospects for a sequel not being great, or I think they start because they produced some animated shorts in addition to this movie.
Okay.
And like with Roger Rabbit, the baby Herman, right, and Jessica Rabbit. Mm-hmm. And there was something about I read something about like, yeah, prospects for a sequel kind of dimming or not being as bright, but not having a sequel, I think, makes this movie this one unique sort of sui generis kind of entry. It is so singular. And granted, like there are, you know, the movies that bring together computer animation and real characters and stuff, but like Who Framed Roger Rabbit is such a unique and individual stylized movie. And I think it helps so much. There isn't a sequel. Not to say that the sequel would have been bad, but it's hard to imagine the sequel would have been better than what we have. So,
I think you're absolutely right. I think it would have been very unlikely that the sequel would have been any good. And that's just because the movie itself almost didn't happen 100 times over. Like, I mean, it's just, you know, Gary K. Wolf almost couldn't publish his book, Who Censored Roger Rabbit? Like, you know, there were all these people along the journey of this movie getting made. I mean, it went through different versions of the script. It, you know, they had entire different animation houses a couple of times working on it. And it's all dependent on, you know, the fact that Disney was kind of going through a transition. They were trying to find ways to be, you know, newer and more edgy and stuff like that and enter sort of like an adult, like, you know, entertainment world, not adult entertainment, but, you know.
Sure.
I mean, it just like and that you've got Steven Spielberg and Robert Zemeckis was basically Steven Spielberg's Zemeckis. Like mentee Zemeckis. At the time. Sorry, yeah. Oh, sorry, Zemeckis.
Robert Zemeckis. Zemeckis. There he is.
Robert Zemeckis. You know, Steven Spielberg was kind of mentoring Zemeckis at the time, and I think that all like, you know, would they have had all those people and all those like, you know. The fact that it went through so many like edits and things like that really made the movie better. So yeah, I agree. I don't think a sequel would have cut it.
Good call.
My last non-serious thing to add, and maybe this is a weird thing as a final thing. I love the singing sword voiced by Frank Sinatra.
On my list. Maybe
it makes me laugh every time I see it.
So glad we got to that.
Totally stops the action.
Best prop. Yeah. Best prop in the whole movie for sure.
It like looks like him. It's so, yeah. Amazing.
I wanted to see a full fight scene with it. I was like, there's got to be a reason it's a sword, right? Like, what? It's got to be able to do something. I don't know what. I had a couple last notes here. Some fun facts for you real quick. We talked about the horrifying execution scene with the shoe.
Yeah.
The voice of that shoe? Nancy Cartwright, a.k.a. the voice of Bart Simpson.
Wow.
Fun fact number two, this is more just for me, but as we're talking about film noir, I did not have a TV growing up. I spent my weekends listening to the radio, part of probably why I didn't see this movie as a kid. And one of the radio programs I listened to every week was Prairie Home Companion, which had a noir play within a play, basically, where they'd put on this play called Guy Noir, who's a private detective. The sound effects, the practical sound effects guy who did on stage sound effects for Prairie Home Companion is named Fred Newman, who is cast as Stupid, who is one of the weasels. So his his vocal acting, his Foley work is all on display in this movie.
Wow.
That's crazy. I was like, Fred Newman, I know that name because I saw Prairie Home Companion live as a kid and saw Fred Newman do his whole thing. It's incredible to watch. So I just like, it's like, man, everyone cool at this moment was in this movie. Everyone went on to great, you know, voice acting prestige after this.
Yeah.
Very cool.
Should we give our ratings for the movie?
Yes. Can I add, I'm just going to end with one last segment I'm creating right now, which is called Intrusive Thoughts, where I'm going to write down a couple intrusive thoughts I had during the movie. One of which is, I think that it's good this movie's in the 40s, because I feel like if it was in the 80s or later, like by that time, the like sex industry in Toontown would be just unhinged. Like the amount of toon human interactions would get real weird. There'd be a lot of whole weird clubs. I'm thinking this hasn't happened yet in this world, but it's coming.
Yeah, it would be less about alcoholism and more about cocaine use.
Yeah, it would be like, hey,
I mean,
you
can you imagine
that, like,
Toontown cocaine? Oh my God.
Are you guys aware
can
that?
Can you imagine him going?
Like Bugs going Bunny to, can just reach behind his back and be like, here's a bag of Coke, you know?
Or them having to, like, Roger Rabbit having to snap, like, get a coked up Eddie Valiant to, like, come back to life. Eddie, please! Don't sit in that chair.
I was like, yeah, I think Toontown in the next 10 years, if there was a sequel, would just be in squalor. Anyway.
That's a good
what's
one.
What's my intrusive thought for this movie?
Personally, as the host of this episode, this is a 5-star movie for me. Meaning for me personally, it means like, this is a movie that everyone has to see. It's just so good. I think in a lot of ways it's kind of a perfect movie. It is super entertaining. It's got all these talented people in it. Mm-hmm. And it is highly unique.
Yeah.
You know, even like we said, even movies like Space Jam don't, you know, even come close. It's a classic.
Edwin, what's your rating scale? I forgot. Or are you going to switch it up every time?
I was going to say, yeah, are we going to switch it up every time? I'll give this movie 2 thumbs up.
The only thing is the three of us have to use different rating scales is the only requirement.
Of course. I don't remember what I used last time, but I'm glad. Okay, this is why I paused, but I'll give this movie 2 thumbs up. This movie is great, and I enjoyed it just as much as I did when I was a kid, and I'm glad that it exists. And it's just such a unique, singular, funny, crazy, strange movie. And it's a movie, now that we've gone through this experience, and I'm really glad you watched it with us for this, it's a movie that I like would love to show to more people.
Yep. Yeah,
yep. Definitely.
It feels like a real landmark movie for a lot of reasons. I mean, not only for the technical achievement, but I would imagine this movie probably kicked off like the run of amazing Disney animation that came throughout the 90s. You know what I mean?
Because this the animation was dying.
Yeah,
totally.
Right.
At this time, animation was dying. You know, there was kind of the old guard of animators who were sort of, you know, just kind of phoning it in.
Oh, and so much new technology was emerging in the 80s with computers that were like, people were probably getting fixated on that, I would assume.
Yeah. I mean, I think that there are people like Richard Williams, the animation director, there's a few people who single-handedly like saved animation. I mean, because now it's gone.
Right.
Right. I mean, you would never be able to make this movie today because like this, you know, style of animation just doesn't exist anymore.
It's kind
it
of just
all be done on the
like
computer.
Miyazaki. Yeah. Like I feel like a lot of I think in anime and Japanese culture, there's definitely alive and well. But as far as like the American animation, like old Hollywood, yeah. I mean, Princess and the Frog came out. Like I don't know what was the last like pure animation like this.
Sure. I mean, I guess you're right. There's like The Boy and the Heron just came out, but like I just don't know if I mean having like I mean these are like animation factories,
right?
You know, and on site where they're, you know, down the road they're filming the scene, mm-hmm. you know, in the soundstage. So I think that's where it's like I don't know how it could exist today.
Are you guys familiar with the film Chippendale Rescue Rangers? I read about this. It came out in 2022. I have not seen it myself, but it was.
I know Rescuers Down Under.
Rescue Rangers, a spiritual successor, I guess, to Who Framed Roger Rabbit. So I'm excited to watch this movie. Yeah, and it's a kids movie, so maybe that's why it didn't maybe register as much for me or for us or for some of the listeners, but I'm excited to watch it. And who knows if it actually is in that regard. But
oh my God, funny. Tim Robinson's about, in it.
Yeah, and like, isn't it Andy Samberg and somebody? I don't know. Anyway, there are movies like this that combine different kinds of animation. I feel like the Spider-Verse movies have done a little bit of this, like with the different Spider-Mans and things like that. And you know, the new Ninja Turtles, I thought, did a really good job with the animation. But it is true that like this, to see the old, that style with like an 80s aesthetic, like there is something kind of magical about it. That feels like it would be really hard to replicate today.
Yeah, true. I love this movie. Speaking, you mentioned Tim Robinson. I just thought, man, he should be an A-lister for voice acting, but he already looks like a cartoon. Like, he already looks animated in real life. He's like, he doesn't need to do voices for cartoons. I'm going to give this a 8.8 out of 10, creeping into... I mean, into the nines, that's, we're talking Desert Island Movie territory. This was just about there for me. I really loved it. I really loved it. I agree that it feels like something everyone should have to see at some age, just for this sort of, yeah, this is an important movie for a lot of reasons. And it's just a like great time to watch. It's a very hard thing to pull off. I can't think of a lot of movies that have been able to kind of straddle both these things at the same time. I keep coming back to Shrek, of like a movie that had a massive cultural impact. Adults like it, kids like it, but you know, Shrek has gone on to be a ton of sequels, you know, and licensed, you know, to hell, but memed
like crazy
so much. But yeah, this movie existed just before all that, and it's, yeah, you're right. There were, how many sequels would there be if this came out today? I don't know, too many. Shout out to Betty Boop. Also, still getting it done all these years later.
I love too when she says, doesn't she say, "What a lucky girl"? About
because Jessica, she's married to Roger Rabbit.
Yeah,
what a lucky girl.
Yeah, I didn't totally buy that, but hey.
Yeah, man. Just like diving into the backstory behind this movie, I feel like there were like. There were heroes who stepped up and made this movie. Like it sounds like they were going to make a crappy movie, like, you know, 20 times. And people like Robert Zemeckis and Steven Spielberg and executives at Disney Richard Williams, like all these people stepped up and said, like, this movie is worth putting some real effort into and some money. I think that is like so cool, and I'm grateful to them for making this awesome movie.
You know, one of the first movies we did on this show is The Terminator. Well, I say that like it wasn't just last episode, but
the last episode.
But that was the first. We talked a lot about the budget of Terminator, which was $6.5 million. So now that's at least for me now forever on this show, I'm going to compare every budget to that budget. And this was $50 million. You said,
yeah, 50. Yeah.
Okay. The more I hear about, and this was 4 years after Terminator. The more I hear about Terminator, I'm like, the more it's becoming an art house sci-fi movie that I can't believe.
Yeah,
$6.5 million. This had 50 million. Oh my gosh.
Yeah,
that's crazy.
I mean, I wonder how much of that went to, you know, the animation, and you know, because those guys just I think animation can be a money suck because it takes so much time and people.
I'm just walking into this now, but it says Terry Gilliam was first offered the director's role for this movie.
That makes sense.
Formerly of Monty Python, you know, Brazil.
Right.
He's made a ton of great. That would have, I mean, I want to see that cut. Oh my God. This would have been a very different movie.
Man, one of these days we should watch, I think it's called Man of La Mancha.
Oh, I've seen that.
I can't remember. The documentary about that is incredible.
Crazy, man.
Well, yeah, that's Terry Gilliam trying to make him. It's just a behind the scenes documentary of them just trying to make this movie, and disaster after disaster occurs. It's so good.
Disaster movie documentaries are just The one about Fitzcarraldo, amazing.
Oh yeah.
Anyway, the what I want to say though is that just reminds me though of maybe he would have, maybe Terry Gilliam, or like it makes sense they would ask him, because the other, I would say, avenue of groundbreaking animation came from Monty Python in the 70s. I mean, their animation style, the way they blended that into their movies and their show, nothing else looks like it, even to this day, the Monty Python animation. So I wonder how much of that he would have incorporated into this movie.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know. I feel like you got to have the Warner Brothers Looney Tunes vibe. You know, that's what
I think he would have played really by
the
rules.
Was the right thing.
But just like the style, like I wonder what direction it would have gone in under him. But that's just an interesting what if. He says he completely regrets the decision to pass on this movie.
Well, there you have it. Who Framed Roger Rabbit? Check it out. It's on Disney Plus. Guys, before we finish up, do we want to announce the next movie that we'll be doing?
Let's pick the next one. I don't think we've actually... Have we talked about it?
We had talked about a movie that Edwin hasn't seen, which is The Big Lebowski.
Oh my gosh.
Correct.
That's a big one, guys.
Yeah, and it's funny. I'm very excited to see this movie. It's a movie I've heard a lot about. It's a movie that I've faked my way through a lot of conversations about. And it's funny, one of the sort of central questions of one of the central themes are around this podcast is the reaction to, you haven't seen that?
Yeah.
Right?
Yes.
And what I'm learning very, very rapidly is that there are so many more movies that I haven't seen compared to Sean and Alex. So even in like these podcasts, they're like, have you guys seen this? And even with the concept of this podcast, I'm like almost embarrassed to say no, or I haven't seen it. But I guess it's a part of my continuing film education. So I'm very excited to see it.
Oh my gosh.
I am a Coen Brothers fan, of course. So yeah.
Just you saying The Big Lebowski, I've seen that movie, I don't know, 15 or more times, and I'm still like, oh, I can't wait to fire it up. This is gonna be great.
What do you know about it, this movie, Big Lebowski?
I know the dude abides, I know the bowling scene, I know that the rug really tied the room together, I know he drinks white Russians.
You know a lot.
There's like a Hispanic, the bowler, I don't
Jesus, yeah,
who am I thinking of? Yeah. I know of that guy. That's about as much as I know.
Okay. Yep. It's pretty good. That's, well, cool. Well, I'm excited to watch that. And we'll be putting that out in a couple of weeks. If you haven't listened to our past episodes, go check out the Now Playing we did about Saltburn. We're going to start doing Now Playing minisodes for current things. If you have any ideas for something that we can do for that, email us at captiveaudiencepod@gmail.com. Would love to get some suggestions for Now Playing episodes and maybe even main feed episodes. So
I was going to say, for the main feed, we the three of us have sat and brainstormed movies that we haven't seen together, or that one of the three of us has not seen. But one of the other sort of ideas is not just big movies that we missed or that we've never seen, but sort of hidden gems or movies that we love that maybe aren't as well recognized or seen by a lot of people, that we can bring these movies in and watch them together. So if you've got movies like that, like a personal favorite that you feel like doesn't get enough love or not enough people have seen, send that our way as well, and we'll check it out.
Awesome. Well, thanks for listening, and we'll see you in a couple of weeks.
Yeah.
Seeking the truth never gets old. Introducing June's Journey, the free-to-play mobile game that will immerse you in a thrilling murder mystery. Join June Parker as she uncovers hidden objects and clues to solve her sister's death in a beautifully illustrated world set in the roaring 20s. With new chapters added every week, the excitement never ends. Download June's Journey now on your Android or iOS device, or play on PC through Facebook Games.